KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Cardinal Ray ha parlato della guerra.
Cardinal Ray spoke about the war. Yesterday, they did not let the Patriarch enter into Gaza, as they had promised. And yesterday, children were bombed. This is cruelty. This is not war. I wanted to say this because it touches the heart.
The Pope has died. Yesterday, on Easter Sunday, he once again called for a ceasefire in Gaza. He was also a fierce voice for immigrants. We'll look at his life and legacy with Reverend Munther Isaac in Bethlehem, Marie Dennis of Pax Christi International, and Robert Ellsberg, editor of Pope Francis's book, A Stranger and You Welcomed Me, A Call to Mercy and Solidarity with Migrants and Refugees. But first, Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen has just returned from El Salvador, where he met with Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father whom the Trump administration mistakenly sent to El Salvador's notorious mega prison, but who, despite a Supreme Court ruling, has refused to return him to the United States.
His conversation with me was the first communication he'd had with anybody outside a prison since he was abducted. He said he felt very sad about being in a prison because he had not committed any crimes.
We'll also speak with Israeli-American Columbia student Josh Drill about the detention of a fellow student, Mohsen Madawi. Josh writes, as Israelis in New York were horrified by ICE's detention of one of our Palestinian partners in peace.
We cannot allow these deportations to happen. They threaten our future. Only together can we stop these deportations. Only together can we stop the bloodshed. And only together can we end the military occupation and create a reality of peace.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Pope Francis has died at the age of 88. The Argentinian-born Jesuit had led the Catholic Church since 2013, when he made history by becoming the first pope from Latin America and the first Jesuit. He made his last public appearance Easter Sunday when he repeated his call for a ceasefire in Gaza, saying the situation was dramatic and deplorable. In November 2023, Pope Francis accused Israel of committing terrorism after Israel attacked a church in Gaza.
A mother and her daughter, Ms. Nahida Khalil Antan and her daughter, Samar Kamal Antan, were killed and others wounded by the snipers as they went to the bathroom. The house of Mother Teresa's nuns was damaged. Their generator hit. Some say it's terrorism. It's war. Yes, it's war. It's terrorism. That is why Scripture says that God stops war, breaks bows, and breaks spears. Let us pray to the Lord for peace.
Pope Francis was also a vocal champion for the poor and marginalized, often spoke out about the climate crisis and against the death penalty. On Thursday, the Pope traveled to a prison in Rome to meet with dozens of prisoners as part of a Holy Thursday ritual. The mayor of Rome, Roberto Galtieri, said today, "Rome, Italy, and the world are mourning an extraordinary man, a humble and courageous pastor who knew how to speak to everyone's heart," unquote. On Sunday, Pope Francis briefly met with U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance in February before he was hospitalized. The Pope openly criticized the Trump administration's attacks on migrants. The Pope wrote, quote, "The act of deporting people who in many cases have left their own land for reasons of extreme poverty, insecurity, exploitation, persecution, or serious deterioration of the environment damages the dignity of many men and women and of entire families and places them in a state of of particular vulnerability and defenselessness, unquote. We'll have more on Pope Francis later in the program. We'll speak with a representative of Pax Christi. We'll speak with Robert Ellsberg, who edited Pope Francis's book. And we'll speak with the pastor, Munther Isaac, in Bethlehem. In Gaza, Israeli forces have killed at least 39 Palestinians in the past day as its relentless and indiscriminate assault continues. The displacement camp of Al-Mawasi near Khan Yunis, a supposed safe zone, has seen heavy casualties. Meanwhile, the Palestine Red Crescent Society has condemned an internal probe by the Israeli military into the killing last month of 15 first responders in Gaza by Israeli fighters. Israel blamed a so-called operational misunderstanding for the mass shooting and burying of the aid workers, along with their fire truck and ambulances. The Palestine Red Crescent Society is calling for a UN-led independent investigation into the apparent war crime. The U.S. Supreme Court's temporarily blocked the Trump administration from expelling another group of Venezuelans under the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. In an unusual move, the court issued an emergency order Saturday morning at 1 a.m. after the ACLU filed a petition warning the Trump administration was preparing to expel more Venezuelans without due process under the rarely used Wartime Act. Two justices dissented from the order, Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas. A federal judge has ordered the abducted Tufts doctoral student, Ramesa Ozturk, be transferred from a Louisiana immigration jail back to Vermont by May 1st. Ozturk, who's originally from Turkey, was arrested near her home in Somerville, Massachusetts, on March 25th, was transferred to three different locations, including Vermont, before being sent to Louisiana. She was targeted for co-authoring an op-ed critical of Tufts' response to pro-Palestinian campus protests. Meanwhile, a Minnesota hospital worker who recently became a father to a baby with special needs has been detained after having his student visa revoked without notice. Aditya Wahyu Harsono, an Indonesian national, is married to a U.S. citizen. His student visa was valid through June of 2026. He has a pending green card application. Harsono frequently posts messages of support for Gaza on social media and runs a small nonprofit selling art and merchandise to raise money for aid to Gaza. More nationwide demonstrations took place over the weekend to protest President Trump. Some of the largest rallies took place here in New York as well as in Washington, D.C.
And if you folks think here today that you're safe, they're just coming for the weak, the powerless, the students, the immigrants. They're not. They're coming for anybody who stands up against them. Law firms, universities, anybody who resists, they come for. So do not be misled, do not be mistaken. This is happening here in our country today. Fascism.
U.S. airstrikes on Yemen's capital Sana'a over the past day have killed at least 12 people, wounded 30 others, according to reports by Houthi media. A separate series of U.S. attacks on Saturday targeted Yemen's Hodeidah's port and airport. This comes as the death toll rose to at least 80 from a major U.S. military assault on the Ras Issa port on Thursday. The deaths included at least five humanitarian workers. The U.S. has been continuously bombing Yemen since mid-March after Houthi fighters vowed to resume targeting Red Sea ships tied to Israel's war on Gaza. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned of the growing risk of regional escalation and called for utmost restraint. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is facing mounting criticism on a number of fronts. The New York Times reports the former Fox News host shared sensitive information about U.S. plans to strike Yemen on a second group chat on the Signal app. Participants in this chat reportedly included Hegseth's wife and brother. Meanwhile, three top aides to Hegseth were fired last week under questionable circumstances, and a fourth former Pentagon official, John Ulyatt, who just resigned as the Pentagon's chief spokesperson, has written an opinion piece in Politico saying it's been a, quote, month of total chaos at the Pentagon, unquote. The United States and Iran held a second round of nuclear talks in Rome and have agreed to meet again next week in Oman. Both sides report progress has been made. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, spoke after the meeting.
There's no reason for too much optimism. We cannot say that we are really optimistic. We must be very cautious. But there is no reason for much pessimism either. We must walk a middle path, reasonable and calm.
In related news, Reuters reports Israel has not ruled out attacking Iran's nuclear facilities in the coming months. The New York Times recently reported President Trump pushed back against an Israeli plan to attack Iran in May. Pakistan has expelled some 80,000 Afghans ahead of an end-of-April deadline set by Pakistani authorities. 2 million more Afghans who've taken refuge in Pakistan are expected to cross back into Afghanistan in the coming months in a policy that's been sharply criticized by aid groups as Afghanistan faces a dire humanitarian and human rights situation. Russia launched nearly 100 drones overnight in Ukraine. After a 30-hour Easter ceasefire ended, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced the unilateral ceasefire Saturday, but Ukrainian officials accused Russia of repeatedly violating it. The Democratic Republic of Congo has suspended the party of former President Joseph Kabila and moved to seize Kabila's assets, accusing him of high treason for his alleged ties to the Rwanda-backed M23 fighters. The M23 have seized two major cities in eastern Congo, Goma and Bukavu, killing over 7,000 people and displacing another 1.2 million since the start of the year. And in news from California, former Democratic Congresswoman Barbara Lee has been elected mayor of Oakland. Lee had served in Congress from 1998 until this year. In 2001, she was the sole Congress member to vote against giving President George W. Bush expansive powers to use military force in retaliation for the 9/11 attacks. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a moment, we're going to talk about the life and legacy of Pope Francis. But we begin today's show with Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, who's just returned from a trip to El Salvador, where he met last week with Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father whom the Trump administration says they forcibly transferred to an El Salvador notorious mega prison last month by mistake. Van Hollen shared a photo of the two seated together at a table in what appears to be a hotel restaurant. Senator Van Hollen traveled to El Salvador last Wednesday in a push for Abrego Garcia's release, but had initially been barred from having any contact with him. Abrego Garcia's wife, Jennifer, celebrated the meeting, saying in a statement, "My children and my prayers have been answered." Abrego Garcia lived in Maryland for almost 15 years after fleeing gang violence in El Salvador. He's a sheet metal worker. Following Van Hollen's trip, four Democratic lawmakers, including Congress members Maxwell Frost of Florida, Yasemin Ansari of Arizona, have arrived in El Salvador, where they intend to continue pressuring for Abrego Garcia's release. For more, we are joined by Senator Chris Van Hollen. Senator Van Hollen, welcome back to Democracy Now! The huge news of the day is the Pope has died. Two of his major issues, once again just yesterday, Easter Sunday, calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. You went to the border there, deeply concerned about Israel's assault on Gaza, and his deep concern for migrants. You just came back from El Salvador, where you met with Abrego Garcia. Why don't we start there? What exactly happened?
Well, Amy, I'm glad you mentioned the Pope. We're all going to miss him. He was a Pope for all of humanity, and Pope Francis was a beautiful soul. So when I met with Abrego Garcia, my main purpose was to let him know that his wife and his kids loved him and that they were fighting for his return, and to let him know that his sheet metal workers union and millions of people in the United States who believe in the Constitution of the United States were fighting for his return and for due process. He spoke about the conditions that he'd experienced, the trauma of having been abducted off the streets of Maryland, trying to make a phone call from the Baltimore Detention Center. They said it was from Baltimore, without being allowed to do that. And of course, then ending up first in the notorious Cecot prison. So it was of course, emotional to hear about the trauma he's experienced. I told him we were going to keep fighting for him. I met with the vice president of El Salvador and said, you really should not be complicit in this Trump administration illegal scheme. And so we will keep fighting for his constitutional rights, because if we deny the constitutional rights for one person, we threaten them for everybody.
So can you tell us exactly what Kilmer said as you met at the hotel? And how is it that you got it totally turned around? First, you're met by, what, Salvadoran soldiers? You're told you can't meet with him. And then just before you left, they brought him out?
Well, first I met with the vice president, and I asked if I could meet with Abrego Garcia. He said no. I said, if I come back next week, can I meet with Abrego Garcia? He said no. I asked if I could call Abrego Garcia. He said no. And so the next day, I tried to visit CECOT, which is this notorious prison, and was stopped by soldiers 3 kilometers short of the prison. And they told me they'd been ordered not to allow me to proceed. I had a number of press conferences in El Salvador with a lot of local press, and I called out this sort of horror of this person having been abducted and denied his constitutional rights, and made the point that El Salvador is violating international law, because international law requires that someone like Abrego Garcia be able to make contact with family, with lawyer, with their lawyers, with others. And so as I was really preparing to leave on Thursday night, we got a call saying that they had relented and that I could sit down with them. And in my conversation, which lasted probably over 40 minutes, we covered a lot of things, from his abduction to the conditions he was experiencing, and many other things. So it's hard to sort of capture all of that. But the bottom line was, he had been traumatized by what happened. He said it was his family, thinking of his family, that gave him the strength to go on. And I think the fact that he learned for the first time that people in America were fighting for his constitutional rights also gave him additional strength.
I want you to explain how much money Bukele is getting, this country of El Salvador is getting, for imprisoning hundreds of men. We don't know what their crime is, if there's any crime at all. But Bukele said on social media about your meeting, now that he's been confirmed healthy, he gets the honor of staying in El Salvador's custody. He also wrote, Kilmer Abrego Garcia miraculously risen from the death camps and torture, obviously mocking. He goes on to say, now sipping margaritas with Senator Van Hollen in the tropical paradise of El Salvador. You've called this Margaritagate. Can you explain what happened and Bukele's, to say the least, cynical remark?
Well, sure. This was, it shows how far Bukele and Trump will go to deceive people and try to change the story. Because what happened was this: when I first sat down with Kilmer Abrego Garcia, if you look at the original, the first photos, you'll see a glass of water and a cup of coffee. As we were speaking, the government folks, Bukele's folks, ordered the waiters to bring these two glasses that were filled with liquid, looked like margaritas because they had either salt or sugar or something around the rim. We of course did not order them. They brought them to the table. If you looked at the one in Kilmer's glass, the liquid was actually a little lower than mine to try to create the appearance that he actually drank it. All of this is a deception. As I pointed out, if you were really Sherlock Holmes, you would see that the sugar or salt or whatever it was around the rim, that there was no gap in it. So obviously no one had a sip. But this goes to the big lie being told by, you know, Bukele and Trump and others to try to create the impression that this person who was in one of the most notorious prisons in El Salvador and now is still very much in detention and in a news blackout is somehow being treated fairly. So these are the lengths they will go, Amy, to try to create this deception, this illusion. They actually wanted to have the meeting by the pool of the hotel. We negotiated away from that, but it was pretty clear what their plan for deception was. And, you know, I think they really bungled it because they did it in such a blatant way that I'm telling you what happened and we're calling it out. And what it demonstrates is what a big lie they will tell.
I know you have to go 15 seconds. How do you see Kilmard coming home? What is your demand and why is this so important to you, Senator?
So two things. Number one, when you have the Trump administration flagrantly violating court orders, I do think at some point, the court is going to have to find the Trump administration lawyers in contempt and sanction them, number one. Number two, we need to keep pressure on El Salvador. I'm going to be talking later today to some officials in the state of Maryland. You know, El Salvador has seen, you know, more American tourists go in there. My view is that American tourists should not be visiting El Salvador when they're participating in this illegal scheme with the Trump administration. State pension funds can look to see whether they want to divest from any companies doing business in El Salvador. So there are ways to put pressure on El Salvador here. And the reason this is all so very important is because when you deny constitutional rights to one person, you are threatening them for every single one of us. That's why this case is so important. If the Trump administration gets away with violating his constitutional rights and violating constitutional orders, court orders, you know, we are already in a constitutional crisis, but it's getting worse by the day.
Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, thanks so much for being with us. Democratic Senator has returned from El Salvador after meeting last week with Kilma Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father, who was sent to the notorious Secot mega prison last month by what the Trump's Homeland Security Department admitted was an administrative error. The lawyer who admitted this in court from the DOJ has been fired. When we come back, the Pope has died. Yesterday, on Easter Sunday, he once again called for a ceasefire in Gaza, was a fierce pro-immigrant voice. We'll look at his life and legacy. Stay with us.
Por la cintura cósmica del sur, piso en la región más vegetal del viento y de la luz. Siento al caminar toda la piel de América en mi piel y anda en mi sangre un río que libera en mi voz su caudal. Sol de Alto Perú, nuestra Bolivia, estaño y soledad, un verde Brasil, besa mi Chile, cobre y mineral. Subo desde el sur hacia la entraña América y total, pura raíz de un grito destinado a crecer.
Canción con Todos, performed by the late, great Argentine singer Mercedes Sosa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. Pope Francis has died at the age of 88. The Argentinian-born Jesuit had led the Catholic Church since 2013, when he made history by becoming the first pope from Latin America and the first Jesuit pope. He made his last public appearance yesterday, Easter Sunday, when he repeated his call for a ceasefire in Gaza, saying the situation was dramatic and deplorable. The pope briefly spoke, then had Archbishop Diego Ravelis read his Easter message.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buona Pasqua.
Dear brothers and sisters, happy Easter.
Maestro di cerimonia.
I ask the master of ceremonies to read the message.
Sono vicino alle sofferenze dei cristiani.
I express my closeness to the sufferings of Christians in Palestine and Israel, and to all the Israeli people and the Palestinian people. The growing climate of anti-Semitism throughout the world is worrisome, yet at the same time, I think of the people of Gaza, and its Christian community in particular, where the terrible conflict continues to cause death and destruction, and to create a dramatic and deplorable humanitarian situation.
The Pope's statement Sunday echoed his past comments. In 2023, on his December 17th birthday, the Pope appealed for an end to the terrorism of war.
And let us not forget our brothers and sisters suffering from war in Ukraine, Palestine, Israel, and other conflict zones. May the approach of Christmas strengthen our commitment to open paths of peace. I continue to receive from Gaza very serious and painful news. Unarmed civilians are being bombed and shot at. And this has even happened inside the Holy Family Parish compound, where there are no terrorists, but families, children, and sick people with disabilities, and nuns. A mother and her daughter, Ms. Nahida Khalil Antan, and her daughter, Samar Kamal Antan, were killed and others wounded by the snipers as they went to the bathroom. The house of Mother Teresa's nuns was damaged. Their generator hit. Some say it's terrorism. It's war. Yes, it's war. It's terrorism. That is why Scripture says that God stops war, breaks bows, and breaks spears. Let us pray to the Lord for peace.
Pope Francis was also a vocal champion for the poor and marginalized and spoke out often about the climate crisis and against the death penalty. On Thursday, the Pope traveled to a prison in Rome to meet with dozens of prisoners. As part of his Holy Thursday ritual. On Sunday, Pope Francis briefly met with Vice President J.D. Vance. In February, before the Pope was hospitalized, he openly criticized the Trump administration's attacks on migrants. The Pope wrote, quote, "The act of deporting people who in many cases have left their own land for reasons of extreme poverty, insecurity, exploitation, persecution, or serious deterioration of the environment damages the dignity of many men and women and of entire families and places them in a state of particular vulnerability and defenselessness," unquote. For more, we're joined by three guests, the Palestinian Christian theologian Reverend Munther Isaac in Bethlehem, Marie Dennis, director of the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative at Pax Christi International, and Robert Ellsberg, publisher of Orbis Books, editor of Pope Francis's book, A Stranger and You Welcomed Me, A Call to Mercy and Solidarity with Migrants and Refugees. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for joining us. Marie Dennis, let's begin with you. The life and legacy of the Pope, if you can talk about it.
Yes, thank you so much. What a gift he has been over these years. From the very beginning, both his way of life, his own witness, and his words have pointed in the direction of peace, of mercy, of nonviolence. Pope Francis, as we many of us remember, immediately after he was elected, gestured by even what shoes he was going to wear and by where he was going to live and by what car he was going to ride in, his own personal commitment to be close to those who were poor and marginalized in our world. And he has continued that throughout his papacy.
Talk about where he took the church when it came to LGBTQ issues, when it came to abortion. He just went to a prison to visit with prisoners, apologized for not washing their feet on Thursday, but said he was not well. If you can talk about all these issues.
Of course. Pope Francis, I think it's important to begin by saying that Pope Francis began when he addressed almost any issue, he would begin with experience, with the experience of people at the margins who were on the receiving end of whatever form of violence or rejection was being exercised. So, for example, with migrants, his first gesture was to go to meet with migrants, to understand their journeys, to understand what motivated them to leave home. When he was challenged by those who were abused by priests and others in the church, he listened to the survivors of that abuse. He listened to LGBTQ representatives, people who were on the receiving end of the exclusion of LGBTQ in our church. And he began to shift his own understanding of a particular situation and to begin to change practice in the church. I think his consistent commitment was to life, but he described that broadly. He talked about violence, the violences that were done to destroy life, that were multifaceted, as you said, beginning with war, with overt violence, with exclusion of migrants, and on and on. So he did not limit the church's understanding of commitment to life to only the issue of abortion, but stretched our imagination to understand that to protect life meant to promote a world of peace, of justice, and to find nonviolent ways to move into the future.
And women.
Yes, and women. Pope Francis, as is often the case, Pope Francis began to listen to women, to hear the experience of women, and he took some quite significant steps to move women into positions of leadership in the institutional church, very high-level positions, which was significant in the Catholic Church. He was not yet ready to talk about women's ordination or to make a change in terms of ordination of women in the Catholic Church. But he, especially during the very large synod process where people from around the world were invited to share their experience and their opinions, he listened carefully, I think, to the insistence of women around the world that we needed to be fully a part of the leadership in the church. So some small steps in that direction, at least a door was open.
I wanted to go to Reverend Munther Isaac, Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem. Last Christmas, he delivered a sermon titled, Christ is Still in the Rubble. His forthcoming book is titled, Christ in the Rubble, Faith, the Bible, and the Genocide in Gaza. If you can talk about the Pope's stand, as late as yesterday, hours before his death, he called for a ceasefire in Gaza. And of course, in the last year, has gone way beyond that, Reverend Munther Isaac.
Yes, this is, of course, a great loss to all humanity, and particularly to the Christian world, to the Catholic world. And we really lament and grieve his loss. And I think that Pope Francis's position on Palestine is just an extension of his theology and pastoral care in general, caring for the marginalized and victims of injustice. What he has done and exhibited and said throughout the war on Gaza was not the first time he spoke for the plight of Palestinians. I think the no Palestinian will ever forget when Pope Francis in 2014 stopped his car, went down, stepped down, and prayed at the separation wall separating Jerusalem from Bethlehem, a moment that touched all of us and continued to speak to us for years. And during the war on Gaza, I think he reflected two very important elements. First, his pastoral heart, his compassion. He spoke almost on a daily basis to the Church of the Holy Family in Gaza. He genuinely cared. He often even joked with them. He would pray with them, which reflect his heart of compassion. But I think his words also went beyond the standard pray for peace kind of language of many church leaders. And this is the distinction of Pope Francis, his courage, his always seeking to push things forward. He spoke, as we heard, on the war as terror, as cruelty. And I think one of the most important things he has said was in a book in which he called for investigation as to whether what Israel has committed in Gaza amounts to a genocide. To me, this is extremely important because it calls for accountability, and it shows that he's more than just compassion and peace. He's for justice. He's for accountability. And I think this is really what's missing from the language of many faith leaders. He was exemplary in that.
Now, you are not a Catholic, but talk about his effect on Christians throughout the West Bank and Gaza, on Muslims as well, as he pushed for more understanding of the Islamic faith, as he talked about migrants, and making this a centerpiece of what he said. It's very interesting, as he called for a ceasefire in Gaza yesterday, the same day that he met with the Vice President of the United States for a number of seconds.
Yes. It's important then to note that here is a Lutheran pastor speaking about Pope Francis as a leader for all of us, because he truly and genuinely reflected, in my opinion, the ideals of the gospel. He was a true follower of Jesus, and he exemplified, not just in words, but in actions, the teachings of Jesus. And as I said, he was truly beloved for us in Palestine because he made us feel recognized in a time when many tried to ignore and dehumanize Palestinians. The way he spoke about Arabs, Muslims in general, I mean, even when there was attacks on the Christian community by some Islamic groups, he would make sure that we distinguish between, for example, what Islam says and what these fringe or radical groups do, warning from the dangers of Islamophobia. So he truly understood the danger of the polemic language that exists in many of our politicians today, and tried to be a bridge builder and fight stereotypes, recognizing that extremism exists in all faith traditions. And for all of that, as I said, he is truly beloved by many who are in the fringe, marginalized, and including here as well in Palestine. And I think you mentioning his meeting with Vice President Vance, I think it's important because in the coming days, and I'm sure we will hear so many good things said from politicians about Pope Francis, the very same politicians who would go on and ignore everything he taught and said, which is never new. I mean, we've seen the same happen with people like Desmond Tutu and others, for example, on the issue on apartheid in Palestine and so on. So it's going to be interesting to hear, to see hypocrisy manifested from the mouth of many politicians who will say all good things about Pope Francis, then go on contradicting many of the things he taught and sought to establish throughout his ministry, whether as a priest, as a bishop, archbishop, cardinal, and of course as Pope.
I want to go right now to the Pope talking about the cardinal, and then you can explain what happened.
Cardinal Ray spoke about the war yesterday. They did not let the Patriarch enter into Gaza, as they had promised. And yesterday, children were bombed. This is cruelty. This is not war. I wanted to say this because it touches the heart.
Can you explain, Reverend Munther Isaac in Bethlehem, what took place last December?
I think the Pope was talking about the incident in which two Palestinian Christian women were shot and killed within the vicinity of the Church of the Holy Family in Gaza. When he said, you know, this is the church, there are no militants there, he clearly was in touch with the people in the church who assured him that No one was in the church campus other than the Christian families who escaped. And so he spoke with clarity, you know, condemning what happened and saying this is cruelty, this is terror, when two innocent women are killed by snipers in front, literally in front of the door of the church for no reason whatsoever. It shows that he recognized that this is not just, you know, as Israel always claimed, they're targeting militants, or that militants hide behind civilians and so on. None of that happened when the churches were attacked. And I think what happened at the churches points to the reality all over Gaza, is that innocent civilians are targeted under the cover or under the justification that, you know, militants are hiding there, whereas in the church, clearly no militants was there. And the words that the Pope chose, I think, were extremely important, whether cruelty, whether terror. I think all of these describe the hell that exists right now in Gaza. And I really wish more faith leaders speak with this moral clarity, describing what is happening right now in Gaza, rather than simply wishing for a ceasefire without calling things by name.
Reverend Munther Isaac, we want to thank you for joining us from Bethlehem. Reverend Isaac tweeted today, "I wonder, will the millions who will mourn his death these coming days respect this wish of his? Will they care for Gazans and Palestinians the way he did?" As we go right now to Robert Ellsberg, publisher of Orbis Books, editor of Pope Francis's book, "A Stranger and You Welcomed Me: A Call to Mercy and Solidarity with Migrants and Refugees." Robert, thanks so much for being with us. If you can talk about his approach to migrants, we're beginning the show with a senator who's calling for a migrant to be brought back to the United States, Kilmer Abrego Garcia. And we're going to end the show with a Palestinian Columbia student who's been imprisoned in Vermont. If you can talk not only about immigrants, but also about indigenous people and the stance that the Pope took, and talk about overall his legacy.
Yes, thank you, Amy. It was clear that the subject of migrants and immigrants wasn't just one topic among many that he addressed, as all popes might. It really was a kind of signature of his papacy. Very ironic that the two people who are most focused on that subject are Donald Trump on the one hand and Pope Francis, representing completely diametrical perspectives. But as Marie mentioned, he signaled that very early. The very first trip he made out of Rome was to this island of Lampedusa, which is a kind of way station where many through the Mediterranean and North Africa had tried to make it there, and many had died, drowned along the way, making, he said, the Mediterranean into a giant cemetery. And that was the first kind of speech he made outside of Rome. And it was directed not just about the suffering of migrants, but about what their condition reflected on the rest of the world, the comfortable world, and what he called the culture of indifference. He made a very pointed challenge when he referred to the story of Cain and Abel. And God says to Cain, who has killed Cain, who has killed his brother Abel, "Where is your brother?" And he says, that's the question that the immigrants are raising to us. He says, you know, who weeps for these people? In the culture of indifference, we're not even able to see our brothers and sisters as our siblings. And so that for him was an extremely vital test of the meaning of the gospel.
Talk about
that we could.
Robert, sorry, if you could talk about his beginnings, talk about how he was chosen, the first Latin American pope, the first Jesuit pope, and also how he even came to take the name Francis.
Also very significant. He came to Rome after the conclave, after the resignation of Pope Benedict. He was at retirement age. He was expecting to return back to Argentina. But instead, he kind of electrified the conclave, which is the meeting of cardinals where they elect the pope, by giving a very short speech of just a few minutes, where he said, "The greatest problem facing the church does not come from outside. It comes from within, from what he called ecclesial narcissism and introversion, the church that's focused in on itself. He said an evangelizing church, a church which represents the gospel of Christ in the world, goes out to the margins and peripheries to touch the wounds of Christ. And that seemed to, that won him the votes to become pope. And as the votes were being tallied, a cardinal from Brazil whispered to him, "Remember the poor." And he says it was at that moment that he thought of St. Francis. Now, no one has ever chosen Francis as a name for a pope before, for probably good reason. Pope for St. Francis associated with poverty, simplicity, the renunciation of power, etc. But it was not, it was very deliberate. And he said he thought of Francis as the poor man. He said, how much I would love a church that is poor and for the poor. And that became really a signal of the agenda of his papacy, his concern for mercy rather than enforcement of rules and orthodoxy, his openness to the earth, his care for creation, reflected in his encyclical, Laudato Si, where he really put concern for the earth at the center of Catholic social teaching, his embrace of nonviolence and opposition to war, his friendship with Muslim leaders and leaders of other religious faiths, and obviously the kind of simplicity and spirit of poverty that he himself embraced. So all of those were very, very significant indications of where, what his papacy was going to be about.
If you can talk about what are the next steps, Robert Ellsberg, and also what it was like to edit the Pope's book, and then what happens now that he has died.
Well, the first thing that will happen will be a period of mourning and his funeral. Cardinals will be summoned to Rome from all over the world, and he has appointed about three quarters of them, and most notably cardinals from the kind of far corners of the world, places that were not usually represented in the College of Cardinals. So many of them don't know each other very well. They'll come together to spend some time together talking, and then they will go into the locked conclave within the Sistine Chapel and begin voting for a successor. People are now a little more familiar with that because of the movie Conclave. I'm sorry, your other question. Oh, but I have experience of editing. I've been at Orbis Books for 38 years, which is a publishing house kind of concerned with global dimensions of faith in the world. We became well known for our publications of liberation theology. So for many years, we were kind of under a shadow in Rome, many of our authors being disciplined and silenced even. And when Pope Francis was elected, it was clear that we had found a pope who really reflected exactly our kind of understanding and mission of the church. So we published about 20 volumes of his writings and books about him on all subjects from war, the environment, the Amazon, mercy, the works of mercy, and my book that I edited on migrants and refugees. So for that, just recognizing what is a signature topics this was for him, I simply went through all of his speeches, writings, prayers, and found just an extraordinary riches in terms of his reflection on this. You know, the title, A Stranger and You Welcomed Me, comes from the text in Matthew 25, where Jesus describes the conditions of our salvation when he says, I was hungry and you fed me, I was naked and you clothed me, I was a stranger and you welcomed me. When did we do this? Insofar as you did this for the least of my brothers and sisters, you did it for me. So it went right to the core of the gospel teaching for Francis about seeing Christ in our brothers and sisters, especially in the poor.
And before we go, in this conclave that will choose the next pope, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, called SNAP, announced recently the creation of a database known as Conclave Watch. The significance of this, Robert?
Well, obviously, one of the momentous crises facing the church over the last decades has been the scandal of sex abuse within the church, and all recent popes have had to confront this in some ways. Pope Francis, I think, more than his predecessors, and yet still there were those who were critical of him for not doing more. So it will be, I think, certainly a question that will go into, it was a question probably not asked before. Anybody who could be considered for Pope has to have be very, very scrutinized over the questions, not just their own, failures as humanly, personally, as themselves or crimes, but they're especially as bishops who covered up the sex abuse of other priests or were not sensitive to the sufferings of the victims. So I think that will certainly be for the first time probably a critical question that will be examined in the conclave.
Finally, liberation theology. If you can address in this 1 minute, and we'll have longer conversations about this in the week, his connection to that and the elevation of liberation theology.
Well, Pope Francis, as you said, is the first Latin American pope, also a Jesuit. He came from Argentina, which was a site of the dirty war and terrible persecution of dissidents of all kinds. He certainly was very familiar with liberation theology, didn't embrace that per se as a name, but he it's so much in the bloodstream of the Latin American church, and particularly the preferential option for the poor, which is something that he embraced definitely. He welcomed Gustavo Gutierrez, the kind of father of liberation theology, to come celebrate Mass with him in the Vatican. He canonized Archbishop Romero, and he made it very clear that the themes of liberation theology, insofar as they had to do with the option for the poor and the defense of those on the margins, and especially the reading the Bible, the whole church's orientation should be done from the perspective of those on the margins. So in that sense, he really brought kind of themes of liberation theology right into the heart of the church and its teaching.
Robert Ellsberg, I want to thank you for being with us, editor of Pope Francis's book, A Stranger and You Welcome Me, A Call to Mercy and Solidarity with Migrants and Refugees, also editor of Orbis Books. Reverend Mother Isaac, Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem, author of Christ in the Rubble, the forthcoming book, and Marie Dennis, a director of the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative of Pax Christi International. Next up, we go to an Israeli-American Columbia student who is fighting for release of Mohsen Mahdawi. He says, as Israelis in New York, we're horrified by ISIS detention of one of our Palestinian partners in peace. Back in 20 seconds.
Liberation theology. One of us suffers, one of us are free. Talking moral values about dignity. Liberation theology, liberation theology. I'm an Irish Catholic boy. Presentation notes didn't bring me much joy. How to read and write, teach and right from wrong. Dale was born at the four, the underdog. System concept is gonna kick my. Didn't bring enough for the rest of the class. Sister said it needs to say, share and share alike. Looking back now, baby.
Go back to the beginning. Irish Catholic Boy by Shaughnessy and the Unity Squad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Trump administration ramps up its attack on international students, we end today's show here in New York. Yesterday, a major protest in Union Square with Jewish New Yorkers and Israelis calling for the release of the detained Columbia student Mohsen Mahdawi, who was arrested in Vermont when he appeared for what he was told would be a naturalization test. He had previously expressed fears about the appointment, which came earlier than usual in the typical naturalization process, and he feared it could end up being a trap. So he wrote to all three legislators in Vermont, Bernie Sanders, Peter Welch, as well as the Congress member Becca Ballant. This is New York controller mayoral candidate Brand Lander speaking at the Union Square protest organized by Israelis for Peace.
This is somebody who grew up in a refugee camp in the West Bank, saw a friend be killed by an Israeli soldier, and yet rather than turn to vengeance and pick up a rock or a gun, turn to Buddhism, becomes a peace activist, and comes here and goes into synagogues speaking about empathy. So his friend, Josh Drill, was here today to speak about him and humanize him. And I thought it would be really important to come here, because when I heard about what happened to Muhsin, I was mad generically. But to get to know him a little through Josh, now I'm mad specifically. And that's the kind of solidarity we need a lot more of.
And this is the Israeli-American Columbia student who Brad Lander referenced, Josh Drill, speaking at Sunday's protest.
We cannot allow these deportations to happen. They threaten our future. Only together can we stop these deportations. Only together can we stop the bloodshed. And only together can we end the military occupation and create a reality of peace.
And Josh Drill joins us now, an Israeli-American peace builder pursuing a Master of Science in Strategic Communications at Columbia University. Co-wrote a piece for The Forward, headlined, "As Israelis in New York were horrified by ICE's detention of one of our Palestinian partners in peace." Josh, we just have 3 minutes, and I know you have a meeting at right after the show. Tell us who and how you know who Mohsen Mahdawi is.
I met Mohsen through a brave group of Palestinian and Israeli students at Columbia. We met for the past months weekly, having intense discussions, sharing our personal traumas, healing together, envisioning a peaceful future and what our place in that is. And it's really important for me to say that these deportations do not keep anyone safe. They endanger us. They endanger us because they separate Palestinian and Israeli peacemakers who are trying to change the reality. We need to continue having conversations. It's a matter of life and death.
And how did you come to know Mohsen? And also the fact that he's head of Columbia's Buddhist Association.
Yeah, so through the group, I came to know Mohsen. And from that, we began having weekly conversations and meetings. I remember specifically in one of our first meetings, Mohsen presented to the group a 20-30 slide PowerPoint presentation about his vision for peace, slide through slide, empathetically and thoughtfully explaining a way forwards. And this is at a time when he already knew that he was under threat of deportation. Mohsen, we're speaking about a deeply empathetic person. We're speaking about someone who understands that the peaceful resolution is a nonviolent resolution, is reconciliation, is collective healing. And I think that this deportation and the threat of it sends a chilling message that peacemakers are not welcome here in America.
You are a student at Columbia University, like Mohsen Mahdawi. What are you calling on Columbia University to do?
I think it's clear that they need to take a stand and not allow their students to be deported. They need to take a public position against these deportations, and they need to make sure that Mohsen next month can graduate his bachelor's degree. And this fall, Mohsen is supposed to start his master's degree in international relations. The university needs to do everything in their power to make that happen.
You write in your piece that the targeting of Mohsen is especially absurd, given his prominent voice in advocating for dialogue and cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians. You believe he was targeted clearly. In this final minute, what is your demand, even beyond Columbia?
Release Mohsen. Stop these deportations. Allow this new generation to continue having conversations, to continue meeting, so that we can build a collective future for ourselves and for our children. What Mohsen represents is new. And new can be scary for some people. But new on both sides of this conflict is exactly what Israelis and Palestinians need to end the conflict and to create peace.
Josh Drill, we want to thank you for being with us. I know you're going to a peace conference in Geneva today. Safe flying. Josh is a student pursuing a Master of Science in Strategic Communications at Columbia University. We'll link to your piece in The Forward. As Israelis in New York were horrified by ICE's detention of one of our Palestinian partners in peace. This is Democracy Now! To see our video and audio podcast, to sign up for our daily digest, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
But the place from where I come, I got a sweet someone there to bless him from. He seems to be all right for me, 'cause I can handle him, you see. I know he can't be true, but then I love him, indeed I do. Have you met my counterfeit Phil from